This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Avram negotiates with Ephraim to buy the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, and immediately after that Avram tells his servant Eliezer to take an oath, Asher lo sikach isho livni mibnois haknani asher anochi yoshev bekirbo. Promise me that you won't take a daughter for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose midst I dwell. Kiyem el artziv el moradati telech, you must go to my land and my birthplace. Velokachto isho livni li Yitzchok, and you shall find there a wife for my son, for Yitzchok. What is it that seems to suddenly create the urgency, not to find a wife, that there can be all sorts of reasons for, but the sudden urgency in Avram's mind that definitely not a Canaanite? And we need to remember also Avram wasn't living like in a time like today, where he might have been living in South Africa, and he says that he doesn't want a South African girl, go to Bnei Brak. Or he's living in Australia and he says he wants a girl from New York. I don't know why, but let's say. Why, in Avram's case, it's not as if there were better people elsewhere. There was one Jewish family, and that was the family of Avram. Apart from Avram Avinu, there were no Jews. They were all idolaters, they were all idol worshippers, they were different nations, different people, different kinds of customs. If Avram was living in Canaan, surely at least in Canaan he would have developed a following. In Canaan there might be people who are fit for Yitzchok. There could be Talmidim, he's been teaching after all. Avram's had a yeshiva there for a long time. There are converts there, there are people he's converted already. Why is there this unbelievable urge on behalf of Avram to get a wife right from, not from, from Canaan, that's the main thing, not from Canaan? What happened? The Klei Yocher points out that you've got to just read the earlier parsha. It was after Avram's business dealings with Ephraim that he realized that he doesn't want a Canaanite daughter for his son. And the Klei Yocher says, he starts off with Rashi, when Eliezer comes to the well, and he says, if the first girl that I ask to give me some water, and she says, not only will I give you water, but I'll give your camels also, you have indicated that girl for your servant for Yitzchok. Explains Rashi, Ru'uyohi, not just by chance, not because of some kind of magic, but Ru'uyohi loy, a girl who functions in that way, who responds in that particular way, is fitting for Yitzchok. Because she's a gemeles chasodim, she does chesed. Uchedai li kanes b'veisu shel Avram, and she would be good to come into the house of Avram. Says the Klei Yocher, Somach parshozu leparshos Ephraim achiti. This parsha comes immediately after the parsha of Ephraim. Ki gam hu ayom mizera Canaan, because he was a Canaanite Ephraim. Ve Ephraim hoyo ro'ayin. And Ephraim had a narrow eye. Ephraim was mean. Ephraim was miserly. That's what there was there. Al kein tzivo laharchik haknanim shehim bali ayin hara. And that is the reason why Avram instructs Eliezer to go far away from Canaan and to get somebody from elsewhere. Ki hakesef yane v'yaid al hakol. Because there's only one test of human character. And that's a complete test that covers all areas. Hakesef yane v'yoyid al hakol. You don't need to know anything more about a person other than the way he handles money. V'chol odom nikar b'kisei. Every human being is understood, is recognized, is examined, proves himself with the way he handles money. In zach v'yosho poloi, if he's pure and he's straight. V'ein l'chol mitzareif v'kura b'chino al ha'odom. There is no other test for human nobility. Kiyim ha'kesef v'azov. But silver and gold, that's the only test. Look how far we've come. When a person looks for a shidduch today, what does he start? What does he look for? What are the things that he looks for? So So let's say already he looks for money. that's actually not what the Klei Yochel means. Apart from the basics, if already one starts to look and to examine what are the things, how frum the person is, how frum the girl is, what yeshiva he's learning in, what sem she went to, that's what's looked for. And if family is looked at, what's looked at in terms of the family, how many generations the family has been frum, how many generations the family has been shomrei Shabbos, have they kept taras hamishpacha for generations, those are the things that are looked for. How often do you find a parent saying, yeah, fine, I hear about the shidduch, I want to check his business dealings, I want to see how he deals in business, that's all I want to know. That's all that interested Avraham Avinu. He was prepared to take an idol worshipper. He was prepared to take somebody from the house of Besuah. Idol worshippers, absolute idol worshippers. People who had no idea, no concept of any kind of hakara of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Totally way out of any kind of religious understanding. But they were honest. Not the Canaanim. Not that the Canaanim were dishonest. Did Ephraim do anything dishonest? What did Ephraim do? He has a piece of property. Avraham wants the property. Ephraim seems to have been quite correct in the way he handled Avraham. Let's just go through the dealings. Avraham gives the story. I'm the foreigner here. I need a place to bury my wife. And they say, please choose wherever you want to. They're very nice. Bury her wherever you want to. Nobody will hold it back from you. He then says, I want to speak to Ephraim. He's got the piece of property that I want. And I want him, v'yitin li es ma'aras ha-machpelo asher lo, I want him to sell me the ma'aras ha-machpelo asher b'ktei sodeu, which is on the edge of his property. I don't want to impinge on his property. Right on the edge, he has a ma'aras ha-machpelo. B'chesef mole yitnenu li. I want to pay the full price, no discounts, I want to pay the full market value. Ephraim is there, and Ephraim answers, in front of all of them, ha-sodeu nosati loch, the field is yours already. And the cave inside the Ma'aras HaMachpelah is yours. In front of everybody, I've given it to you. Go ahead, use it. It's a gift. What's wrong with that? And he says, no, please do me a favor. Nosati kesef asodi. I've made available the money for the field. Do me a favor. Kach mimeni. Accept the money. I want to buy it. I don't want it as a gift. So Ephraim answers. Okay, it's a 400 shekel kesef. What is it between you and me? It's not a lot of money. Go ahead. Avraham listens to Ephraim, and it says, "Vayishma Avraham and Ephraim." And Avraham listens to Ephraim. Vayishkel Avraham le Ephraim es hakesef ashidiber beozdei bnei ches. And Avraham weighed out the money that Ephraim had determined in the presence of the bnei ches. 400 shekels of kesef that are used in the market. Rashi points out, Vayishku el Avraham le Ephraim, Omar harbe ve'afilu miyat lo yaseh. Field, no price, it's a gift for you. A very, very generous gesture. But afilu ma'at lo yoso, but when it came to action, he did very little. Shenotal mimenu shkolim gedoilim kantorim shenemar oivel l'seiche. Shenitkablim b'shekel b'chol mokre. They're shekels and shekels. They are shekels that are used in domestic currency, just in Canaan. And then each country has its own currency. The shekel was a term that was used, it's like a dollar. Well, there are United States dollars, there's Australian dollars, and there are Canadian dollars. And the Singaporean dollars, they're all sorts of different dollars. If a person says $400, that's all he asks for. So if he's in America, he means American dollars. If he's in Australia, he means Australian dollars. Avraham didn't give him the dollars of Canaan, says Rashi. He gave him international currency. He gave him 400 shkolim that could be used in any country. That means he used the most expensive shekel that there was. The most expensive unit of currency that there was. So in our terms it would have been like pound sterling. It says 400. So Avraham doesn't say 400 rand. And he doesn't give him $400. He gives him 400 pounds sterling. So there can be no question at all. He gives him the most, then it wasn't 400. 400 shekelim is not like 400 rand, and it's not like 400 pounds sterling. It was real money in those days. So it was a lot of money. But Avram goes and carefully gives him a currency that can be used anything, anywhere in the world, which is not only not giving him the cave for nothing, but he's taking a price for it which is way above the market price. Why does Avram do that? If he asks for 400 shekel, why does he do it? If you'll notice the wording of the posuk, Vayishma Avraham el Ephraim. Avram heard Ephraim very carefully. He didn't just see what was written in the contract. He heard what was in Ephraim's tone of voice. And he heard that Ephraim wanted a good price for it, not just the market price. He understood that what Ephraim was saying and what Ephraim meant were two different things. Just as when Ephraim said, here it is as a gift, Ephraim didn't mean that, and Avraham knew it. When Ephraim said, 400 shekelim, what is it between you and me? Avraham knew that he didn't mean 400 shekelim, ordinary shekelim. He didn't mean 400 South African shekelim. He meant 400 shekelim that can be used anywhere in the world. He meant the finest of currency. That's what he meant, and it was a hefty price. And that was the essence of Ephraim. That Omar harbei ve'afilu mi'at lo yoso. The essence of Ephraim's business dealings is when he's standing in public, lo bosnei b'nei chet, when all the people are present, he makes these magnificent gestures and he talks big. But when it comes to the deal, all of a sudden he becomes mean and small-minded and demanding. That was Ephraim. Says Avraham, from that experience I've learned, and only from that experience. I've lived with him for a long time, but I haven't done business with him. From that experience, as Avraham, I've learned, I don't want a Canaanite for my daughter. Anybody else, idol worshippers are just fine, but not a Canaanite. Not somebody whose business dealing is built on big promises and small performances. Rather the other way around. And so, Eliezer goes now to look for this girl. And we now understand why he gives her this particular test. What is he testing her for? As we've mentioned before, when a young man and a young girl go out, if they're from secular society, they go out and who knows what kind of irrelevancies they talk about, if they talk at all. If they're from frum society, they talk about very relevant things. They talk about what sem you went to and what yeshiva you went to. And they talk about whether you eat chol of Yisrael, whether you only drink chol of Yisrael or you don't only drink chol of Yisrael. And they talk about whether you have Mahadrin or you have Rabbi Sternbuchs. And what would you do if you have Rabbi Sternbuchs and you're in a house where they give Mahadrin? What would you do then? That's what they talk about. And if they really, when it's really getting serious, when they're about to propose, when one is about to propose to the other, they might even get as far as saying, what kind of school would you want our children to go to if we get married? That's about as far as they would go. There's only one test that Eliezer gives. And that's small promises and big words and big deeds. Or big promises and small deeds. That's all he's interested in. How she does business. How she interacts with people. That's all that's important. Does she interact with people with an eye in ro, or with an eye in tova? Does she have a good eye, a big eye, or does she have a small eye? But it's much more than that that he's testing. He's not just testing the quantity of how she responds to him. She asks for a little water, and she gives a lot of water. That's the first thing that needs to be tested, and the Sipurna makes that very clear when he says, "Ki ro'i l'shoel sheyishol pochos mitzorko." What happens when you go into negotiation? You go into negotiation if you want, let's say, you want a salary increase or you want a job, and you're prepared to take the job for 4,000 rand a month. What do you do? You don't go in asking 4,000 rand. You go in asking 6,000 rand. And if the employer, the prospective employer, is willing to pay you 4,000, he doesn't offer you 4,000, he offers you 3,000. And then you start negotiating. But look what the Sipurnu says, Ki roi l'shoil sheyishal pochos mitzorko, shaloi l'hatriach. The one who's asking ought to ask less than he wants, not more than he wants. Should ask less, so as not to be an imposition. But we can't do that in our society, because if we ask less, we'll get less. So we have to ask more. So in our society and in our kind of business dealings, if you want to buy a property for 200,000 rand, you've got to make an offer of 150,000 rand. And if the person wants to sell it for 200,000 rand, they've got to ask 300,000 rand. And that's how the negotiation starts. It's built on sheker. You've got to cheat each other. You've got to lie to each other in order to do the business. But it should be the other way around. The person who wants to buy it should be willing to pay a little bit more than is being asked for it necessarily, a little bit more than its market value. So not to make a big deal. And the one who's selling it should be willing to take perhaps a little bit less. And certainly in matters of favors where people are just dealing with each other and it's not a matter of cost, but just of energy and of time, the one who's making a demand on the other should demand a little less than his needs. Shalila Atriach, to convey a message. The message I'm conveying is that I value you. And although I need something, I'm asking you for less than I need. The royal in a div, but the other person, she Yosef, he has to ask for more than he needs. He has to ask for more than he's got to offer more than he's been asked for. That's the way it should be. Doesn't always work like that. If a meshulach, if a Rosh Yeshiva comes to see one, and you say to him, "What do you want from me?" If he says, "Whatever you can do, if you can do 18 rand, that will be very nice. You can do 100 rand, that will be very nice." What do you say to yourself? "Phew, got off lightly. I thought he was going to ask for more." So he asked for 18 rand. You don't give him 18 rand. You give a little bit more than that, maybe. But the feeling is, "I got off lightly." Shouldn't really be like that. So he doesn't. So he says, "What do I want from you? I would like you to dedicate a room. $1,500, $5,000, you start sweating. And that way you start negotiating, and eventually he gets 1,000 rand from you instead of $5,000. But 1,000 rand is better than 18. So he's done a good job. You feel you've got off lightly. He wanted $5,000, you've given him 1,000 rand. He feels he's done well. He could have asked for 18 rand, he could have got 18 rand, he got 1,000 rand, and everybody's happy. But that's not the way it should be. He should be able to say, "I don't want to impose on you. I know things are difficult. Whatever you can give." You should say, "Position, it's a pleasure for me to give. I want to give as much as I can." That's the relationship that is meant to be. And imagine the quality of that interaction when that interaction is there. That's really what it should be. When you're dealing, if you're selling an item, you should be the other way around. How does it work now? The buyer comes in and starts with the first question he asks. Before he asks the price, what does he ask? "How much is the discount?" The first thing he asks. Afterwards he comes to the price. Should be the other way around. The seller should say, the first thing he should say is, "I would like to give you a special price. I would like to give you a discount." And the buyer should say, "No, how can I take a discount from you? How can I do you out of something? If that's the market price, I would like to pay the full price." And that's how the negotiation should be conducted. With the seller saying, "No, please, please, I would like to do something special for you." And the buyer saying, "But how can I take it?" Imagine the quality of business. And Eliezer starts off that way. That's what he wants to check. He wants to check that this girl has nothing, absolutely nothing of Ephraim in her. Ephraim offers a lot and gives a little. He wants to ask her for a little and see her offering a lot and see her giving a lot more than he's asking for. Because that shows the business dealing, that shows her way of handling people and handling money. And as the Kleyoko says, "Ve'ein lecho metzareif v'chura b'chino al ha'odom, ki im hakesef v'hazov." There's no better way to test a person than by the way he handles money. Let's understand that a little bit more deeply, and in the process of doing so, I'm going to tie together the lady's shiur from this morning with this afternoon's chovos halavos and apply it to the parsha. We spoke last Motzei Shabbos about the fact that the imohus, that the mothers of the nation, with the exception of Leah, were all barren, and we said the fish misave Hakadosh Baruch Hu l'tfilosam shel tzadikim, because the Ribbono Shel Olam craves for the tefillah of a tzadik. And we explained, when we explained also the parsha of Yishmael, that it's not just that he wants the tefillah of people who are tzadikim. That he can have any time a tzadik davens shachris, every time a tzadik davens mincha or maariv, he's getting tefillahs of tzadikim. That's not what it means when it says misave Hakadosh Baruch Hu l'tfilosam shel tzadikim. What it means is that tefillah, that prayer that is given from a position of tzidkus, from a position of righteousness. And when is there that position of righteousness? When the pressure's on. When the person is suffering, when the person is under pressure and he turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam in prayer, at that moment he's a great tzaddik. At that moment he makes all sorts of promises, he makes all sorts of undertakings. If I get out of this, I'll give tzedakah. If I get out of this, I'll learn more. If I get out of this, I'll teach. People find themselves in that state of desperateness, they're willing to take upon themselves levels of Yiras Shamayim that they don't normally take. That's the tefillah that Hashem wants. And so Hashem puts on the pressure in order to give that kind of quality of tefillah. That's what we said last week, and we need to take that idea a little bit further. and say, what kind of tefillah is it that the Ribbono Shel Olam really wants? And the Medrash in Shir HaShirim on Yoinosi Bechag VeHasela says, where Hashem says that my precious dove is in the creeks of the rocks, right inside the cracks of the rocks, and it's good for you. I like it when you're there. Ki Kelech Orev, because your voice is so pleasant. I like to hear it. And the Medrash in the Yalkut says, Hashmi'eni es Kelech, let me hear your voice. Bahalel, let me hear you saying the Hallel. Ki Kelech Orev, because your voice is pleasant. Behoidu la Hashem ki tov, when you say Hoidu la Hashem ki tov, I enjoy it so much, your voice is so pleasant. Umarech navo, and you look so good. Ba'ano Hashem hushiyono, ba'ano Hashem atzlichono, when you say, please Hashem, save me, please Hashem, make me successful. That's, you look so good when you say that. And I explained in the ladies' shiur this morning, it's a very odd thing. What is Hashem saying? I enjoy hearing your voice. When? When you're doing what? Explains the Medrash, it's not the quality of your voice that I enjoy, even if you don't have a good voice. In our base of Medrash, not everybody has a wonderful voice. That doesn't mean that Hashem doesn't enjoy the davening. He can still enjoy the davening. It's not just the voice. It's what the people are saying more than how they're saying it. And what are they saying? What does Hashem enjoy? When you say, Hoidu la Hashem ki tov, thank you, Ribbono Shel Olam, thank you. You're wonderful, Ribbono Shel Olam, you're so good. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam enjoys. And when we say, Ano Hashem, I enjoy, Hashem loves to see us. When we say, please Hashem, save us, Hashem loves it, He enjoys it. And I suggested in the ladies' shiur, simply let's transpose that into a human situation. And imagine a scene with a psychologist or a psychiatrist and a big industrialist sitting on his couch. And he says, I've come to see you, psychologist, because they tell me I'm a funny sort of a person. And he or she, the psychologist, says, what's the matter with you? And he says, you know, I really love my employees. So she says, what's wrong with that? That's very nice. He says, but I love it best when they go on their hands and knees and they beg me. That's when I love them best. And so I make their life a misery so as to bring them onto their knees. I exploit them. I really give them a tough time. I don't attend to their needs. Not because I don't like them. Because I love them. I love to see them plead to me. That's when I love them most. And then when finally I give them something, they say, Hoidu, they say, thank you, Master, thank you. And that's the best feeling of all. Is there anything wrong with me? What's the psychologist going to say? Of course there's something wrong with you. Absolutely, you're a sick man. We need to fix you. What kind of business is this? That you need people to go on their hands and knees, and otherwise, and if nobody goes on their hands and knees, no, then I'm not a happy person. And if nobody writes you beautiful thank you letters, no. He says, you must come to my office and see on the walls I've got framed all the thank you letters I've got. I've got a huge office and you can't see any wall, you can't see any of the wallpaper. It's plastered with thank you letters. Every charity I've given to, every person I've helped, every employee that's gotten a promotion, they know already that if they don't say thank you, that's the last promotion they get. So they write me the most beautiful letters and I put them on the wall. And without those letters, I would feel terrible. I would feel useless. She would say, I can see we're going to be busy together for a long time. We've got a big job here. That's the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's Hashem is saying that, and quite shamelessly, and not even to his psychologist. He's telling us all. That's the way I am. I love it when you plead to me. I turn the screws on to make it rough for you because I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. When you get onto your hands and knees and you cry, I love it. What kind of thing is that? So we have two options. The one thing is we can say, Chas v'sholem, the Ribbono Shel Olam is psychologically ill and he needs a shrink. And say, look, he's a megalomaniac. That's the one option we have, which obviously isn't an option, which leaves us only with one other option, and that's to say the psychologists are on the wrong track. But that's not a sign of megalomania. But it's not so. And I'm not sure which encounters more resistance. I tend to think that to say that psychology is wrong would encounter more resistance than to suggest that Hashem is a megalomaniac. To suggest that Hashem is a megalomaniac, people would probably accept that generally in the world. But to say that psychology has made a mistake, that's sacrilege. You can't say such a thing. But we will say such a thing. And that is that Hashem teaches here that a dependence on human approbation, on human reinforcement, on praise, on building people up, that dependency is not a negative dependency. There are certain dependencies that are negative. To be dependent on a drug is negative. to be dependent on people for normal functions. A person who can't walk without help, it's a terrible thing. A person who can't eat without help is a terrible thing. A person who can't go about his normal duties without help, that's a terrible thing. But what we seem to be taught here is that to need approval and praise and thanks, that's not a negative thing. That's absolutely normal. That's how Hashem created the world. And He created it because it's positive, because He wants it that way. He wants people to be dependent upon one another. Not for their physical needs. We're not dependent on each other for our physical needs. We're dependent on the Ribbono Shel Olam for our physical needs. Hashem provides for us. We don't need each other for that. In all the things that we think we're dependent, if you ask people, what is dependency? Where is value? Well, we'll say society is we're dependent on one another. We can't operate. We're interdependent. We need each other. Countries need each other. Societies need each other. Individuals need each other. Why, you'll say, why do we need each other? In what area? Go around, ask people in the street tomorrow. Anybody, ask the people you work with. Ask your friends. In what area are people dependent on one another? And they'll say, not everybody can grow food. So I'm a lawyer, you can grow food, I'll do your legal work and you'll provide me with food and we'll exchange money. We're dependent on one another. I'm dependent on the police for protection. I'm dependent on my mechanic to look after my car. Everybody's dependent. They'll think, what a silly question. But nobody will say to you, I'm dependent on other people and really only one thing. And that's my self-esteem. That's the only thing that I'm really dependent on other people for. Because if you say that, you will be labeled as in need of psychological help. You mean you need other people for your self-esteem? Do you value yourself so little that you need other people for your self-esteem? You'd better go and see a shrink. There's something wrong with you. You should have enough self-esteem not to need other people. You mean if people don't thank you, you feel insulted, you feel belittled? You mean if people don't praise you and show your worth, you feel belittled? You're in need of psychological help. This Chazal teaches us that's not so. Because Hashem isn't in need of psychological help, and He needs praise too. As I pointed out this morning, what percentage of our davening is praise, and what percentage of our davening is asking for our needs? We go through pages and pages and pages of Psukei Dezimra. We start with Brochus in the morning, Psukei Dezimra, the Brochus before the Shema itself, the Brochus after the Shema, praise, praise, come to Shmona Esra, the first Brochus is praise, the second Brochus is praise, the third Brochus is praise. Then we've got 13 brochas where we ask for our own needs, and the 14th, and then we've got again another 3 brochas where we praise Hashem, and then we've got Ashrei, and Avol Tzion, and Aleinu. Praise, 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 the whole thing. What kind of relationship is that? Where we, in 45 minutes or an hour of davening, we spend 80% of it praising, and maybe 10 or 20% of it asking for our own needs. What kind of business is that? Imagine if you had to go into your boss and you had to discuss a business matter with him, or you had to ask him for something, and you knew that unless you spent 80% of the meeting praising him, you wouldn't get a thing. So you go in there, you've got an hour with him, and imagine that for 45 minutes you have to tell him how great he is and how wonderful he is and what a pleasure it is working for him, on and on and on. And then you can say for 5 minutes, by the way, while I'm here, can you help me out with such and such? And you know that without that you're not going to get it. That's what he demands. What would you say about such a boss? We would think there's something wrong with him. What kind of business is it? So the boss doesn't demand that of you. The reason the boss doesn't demand that of you is not because he doesn't want it. Every boss does want it. And every employee wants it too. Every employee would love it. Imagine if every time an employee got an instruction, it was preceded by 20 minutes of praise. You're wonderful, you're the best I've ever had, you're tremendous, I can't manage without you. You're just one. You surprise me every day with how good you are and how wonderful you are. By the way, can you just file these papers for me? Do you want to tell me that an employee wouldn't like it? Do you want to tell me that an employee wouldn't enjoy it? Of course he would. And vice versa, when the employee wants an afternoon off, and he or she comes to the boss and starts, how wonderful it is to work for you, what a pleasure it is, you're such a magnificent person, you're such a generous person, you're such a wonderful person. By the way, can I have the afternoon off? Assuming it was genuine, do you think he wouldn't enjoy it? So why don't we demand it? The reason we don't demand it is because we'll be considered sick. Nobody, if there's something wrong with you, if you need such things. Because it's been drummed into us that if you need praise, that if you need approval, that if you need reinforcement from others, you're inadequate, you're insufficient. But it isn't so. That's godly. That's just the way the world is created. That's part of the godly part of us, not the animal part of us. The need for approval, the need for praise is something that Ribbono Shel Olam gives us. And it starts with a child. If it weren't so, why does a little baby need it already? If it's something, if it's a negative thing, where does a little baby need it already? Where does he develop this inadequacy from? The psychological insufficiency from? And at what point do we wean him off it? He doesn't get weaned off it. He just learns from society that he must subdue that need. Yes, you've got a need for praise, but it's not the kind of thing you express, because if you express it, people will refer you to psychologists and psychiatrists. So just keep quiet about it. So we've learned to do that. And the result of that is we don't give each other praise, and we don't demand praise from one another. Praise in the widest sense. There are all sorts of ways of praising, and we'll discuss it briefly in a moment. And that says, Hashem, I enjoy it when you say, Hodul Hashem. I enjoy it when you say, Ono Hashem Hoshiyana. It makes me feel important, Kabyocha. Funny thing to say. Hashem, it makes me feel valued. It makes me feel needed. What does a human being feel like when they don't feel needed? What does a human being feel like when he doesn't feel valued? What does a husband feel like? What does a wife feel like? What does a child feel like? What does an employee feel like? What does anybody feel like? It's the worst feeling that there is. That need to feel valued is not an inadequacy. That need to feel valued is part of the way that Ribbono Shel Olam built the world. It's part of the way Hashem himself functions. Hashem, so to say, has created within himself the need to feel valued by us. That's his need. And we can fulfill that need. We discussed in the ladies' share this morning that gives the human being enormous power. Enormous power. It gives a person power even to think that he can affect the way another person feels. That to affect the way Hashem feels, that's enormous power. And it's a wonderful feeling. That I have the power not only to impact on my fellow human being, but I have the power to impact on the Ribbono Shel Olam. On the Ribbono Shel Olam's sense of his own value, so to say. That's something that I'm able to do. That power is something that is terribly misused. Because people are so afraid to use it properly, they use it negatively. And that is the same as I have the power to make somebody feel good, I have the power to make somebody feel bad, to make somebody feel worthless. And using that power is the way people feel adequacy. It's a terrible thing. I feel adequate by making that. Look what I can do. I can reduce somebody to tears. Isn't that wonderful? Aren't I wonderful? That's how people run around. And if you look at it, that's really how business operates. If I walk into your shop and you're selling apples, if I come in and say, my goodness, these apples are magnificent, they're beautiful, and you only want so and so many rand a kilo, my goodness, what a pleasure. I'm not going to say that, because if I say that, you'll put the price up next time. So what do I say if I'm serious about dealing in apples? If I don't want the apples, then of course I'll say that. One of the things they teach you when you go into sales is if the customer compliments your goods, you know, don't waste any more time with him. He's not in the market. Person who comes into your shop and says, how lovely, how beautiful, wonderful goods, everything's fantastic, he's not in the market. You know that for sure. My salespeople still haven't learnt that. They phone me up, oh, got a wonderful opportunity. Somebody came in and very interested, they think the goods are wonderful. And they get very upset when I say, then don't waste any more time with them. Get into somebody who doesn't think they're wonderful. That's where your market is. Because if a person's serious about buying, the first thing he's going to do is knock you. You're good, terrible. And your price, even worse. And your service. Have you any idea what your competitors are doing? Then you know you're serious. Why is he knocking you? Because he wants the price to come down. He wants to devalue you. He wants to shake you to the point where you don't believe in your own value. Because as long as you believe in your own value, you're going to hold out for what you know you're worth. As long as you believe in the value of your own merchandise, you're going to hold out for what it's really worth. So he has only one choice in our kind of environment. And that is to try and convince you that you're worthless, and your company is worthless, and your merchandise is worthless, and your service is worthless, everything's worthless. I had a salesman who said to me once, he can do a lot more sales if I don't give him a minimum price at which he can sell. I said, thank you very much. What do I need you for? Just put an advert in the paper, come and help yourselves on such and such a day. Well, that's what you're telling me, is that your customers have managed to convince you that you're worthless. And that's their job. Their job is to try and convince you that you're worthless, and that's the way we operate. And that's the whole business environment in which we operate. And by business, I'm talking the widest sense as interaction. All our interaction is built on trying to communicate to the other person that they are worthless, because that gives me the power. When in actual fact, that ability to influence the value of one another is something that was given to us to do exactly the reverse, to make the other person feel how valuable he is how truly worthwhile he really is. That's the power that the Ribono Shel Olam gives us. But we don't use it that way. That's all Eliezer wants to test. Here comes an Eved, a slave, asking for some water. He knows she'll give him the water. Anybody would. Any decent human being. A man comes along, says, I'm thirsty, can you give me some water? What are you going to say? No, help yourself. Any decent human being will see that he's had a long journey and she'll give him something to drink. What he wants to see is something else altogether. He wants to see whether she does it in a way that makes him feel like a tired Eved, or in a way that makes him feel like a glorious king. That's all he wants to test. He wants to test the quality of service. That's it. Because that will determine what kind of a person she is. And that's all he needs to know. How she operates. What's the difference between an ayin toivo and an ayin ro? When we talk about an ayin hora, everybody talks about ayin hora. What is it? What is an ayin ro? Ephraim. What is that ayin ro? An ayin ro is that my greatness is built on your weakness. The more I can take from you, the more I've got. An ayin toivo is the more I can give to you, the more I've got. It's a different kind of perception. There is an amazing consultancy firm in the United States, probably the best consultancy firm in the United States. They go into companies and they consult, but their consultants are highly skilled and highly trained. And what inevitably happens is that the consultant goes into a company and consults for the company and turns the company around. The next thing, of course, is the company offers the consultant a job. And the consultant takes the job. What the company doesn't realize is that's part of the strategy of the consultancy. They want their ex-consultants to be placed in all the key businesses in the United States. That gives them total control. Who do those ex-consultants turn to? Who do they use? The consultancy, of course. Most consultancies have the opposite. You're not allowed to take a job with one of your clients. We don't want the client to get hold of you. We want to keep it all for ourselves. We don't want our technology to go to them. This company just turned the whole thing around and said, our strength comes from what we can give, not what we can take. The more we can give, the more we get. The more we're around, the more we give of ourselves elsewhere, the stronger we are, not the weaker we are. An ayin ro'o is a narrow eye that you look at everything in terms of, if you've got it, I haven't, so I'm weak. And the only way I can get strong is by pushing you down. An ayin toivo is exactly the opposite. By my giving to you, that affirms my potency, that affirms my value. If I am the source of something that you need, and I'm able to give it to you, that makes me more valuable, not less valuable. The one measures value in terms of consumption, as we discussed 2 or 3 weeks ago. The one thinks that the more I take, the bigger I get. And the other says, no, the more I give, the bigger I get. And the difference is whether you look at the human being as a creative source or as a consuming source. If you see the human being as an animal, as a sophisticated animal, as the secular world does, based on the theory of evolution, we're just a sophisticated animal, then yes, the more I consume, the bigger I am. The more I take for myself, the bigger I am. But if you look at the human being as a chelek eloiko mimal, as a part of Hashem himself, then I am an endless source capable of generating, capable of creating, and the more I give, the stronger I am. A creator is strengthened by what he gives. A consumer is strengthened by what he takes. So secular society requires the human being to see himself as a taker. You need a religious approach in order to see yourself as a potential giver, someone that can give. And look how intricately bound together is emuno, a belief in Hashem, and an effective functioning in the world. You can't separate the two. Unless you see yourself as having something godly, something endless, something limitless, something creative, you're going to try and take. And the only way you can take is by putting everybody else down. If I want to take, I've got to get things at the cheapest price possible. To get it at the cheapest price possible, I've got to knock the other person. So my whole life becomes one of knocking the other person, because I'm not sure of my own value. Is the other way around, is how do I know of my own value? If I have something that everybody needs, then I have value. If I can give, if I have, like Yosef had in Mitzrayim during the famine years, he had all the food, that's value. There he knows that he's got what everybody needs, and he dishes it out. That's value. When we understand that we have something valuable that other people can need, and we give that to other people, that's where we have a sense of value. And that's what Eliezer wanted to test with Rivka. Does she see herself, does she need to run other people down in order to feel good? Or can she build other people up and feel good that way? That's all he wants to know. And look what she does. Behinei Rivka Yetzes. Rivka comes out. Bechado al shichmo. And she's carrying the kad on her shoulder. In a very elegant way. She's not walking like a servant or a slave. She's walking in a very elegant way. Bahanaro toivas mar'e me'oid. She's a very beautiful young lady. That's important. Because sometimes if it's an ugly person and an inadequate person, maybe they're being nice because they feel inadequate. But she doesn't feel inadequate. She walks with beautiful bearing, holding her pitcher on her shoulder, and she's magnificent to look at. Besulo ve'ishlo yodo. Had no previous relationships with any man. Bateret ha'ayno, and she comes down to the well. Now what do you think the expectations are of such a girl as she comes down to the well? There'll be a string of men waiting to help her. Can I fill it up for you? Can I help you? It'll be a string of men. So this is a reverse situation, where you've got a man who says, excuse me, can you give me some water? So is she going to say, you so-and-so, you chauvinist, help yourself. Well, why should I give you water? She's got the world at her feet. She comes down to the well. Vayorotz ha'eved likroso. He comes running up to her. Ha'eved, he's a slave. He looks like a slave. He's projecting the image of a slave. So there is this beautiful princess. And that's how you've got to perceive her. A beautiful princess. Wealthy. Noble. Has everything at her feet. And the slave comes running up to her. Vayomer, and he says, Hagmi'ini no ma'at mayim mikadech. Please may I taste a little water from your pitcher. So she should say, there's a well there. Help yourself. Why does it have to be from my pitcher? Why do you want to taste my water? It's no different from anybody else's water. It's a public well. Help yourself. That's what she ought to say. Batumer, and she says, Shisei Aduni, my master, please drink. She calls him my master, but he's a slave. What's so important about that? Does she call everybody my master? If she calls everybody my master, then it's unimportant. Then she's non-discriminating and non-discerning. And the fact that she calls him my master is irrelevant. Call everybody sir, then the word sir doesn't mean anything. But she doesn't. And now the Torah wouldn't have recorded it if it wasn't important to notice those words. She has responded to a nobility in Eliezer. He looks like a slave. He's dressed like a slave. In every way, he functions like a slave. But he doesn't talk like a slave. He doesn't say, give me some water. Hagmi'ini no ma'at mayim mikadeh. Let me taste just a little water from your kad. Now she knows he needs a lot of water. She can see he's tired. She can see he's thirsty. What does he want? Just a taste. So she asks herself, why is he only asking for a taste if what he means is a drink? And that the Targum translates it that. V'omar, he says, at imni cha'an ze'er mayo mikulteh. Give me a little taste of water. Why do you ask for a taste? If you're thirsty, then ask for a taste. A taste you ask for if I'm cooking something delicious and you're not hungry, all you want to do is taste it. You want to taste the flavor. But water has, there's no flavor. A person doesn't want to taste water. You only want water if you're thirsty. So she works out. Why is he saying that? Because of what the Sipurnu said earlier. Ki ro'i l'sho'il sheyishol pochus bitzolka. It's noble, it's fine for a person to ask for less than he wants. She identifies in him that kind of a person who's totally non-exploitative, absolutely not willing to take advantage, who asks for much less than he wants. And she realizes, and that's why she refers to him as Adoni. And he notices that she's noticed the way he speaks. So he notices that that's important to her. He notices that that determines status. That she's not looking at his external appearance. She's not looking at anything flashy about him. She's not looking at every other aspect, he's an evet. There's only one thing, and that is by the choice of words he uses. If she's perceptive enough, she'll notice that he comes from the house of Avraham Avinu. And she notices. And she calls him Adoni. She calls him my master. She doesn't stereotype him. Foreigner, slave, old man. Adoni, my master, you have something very noble about you. And she responds and recognizes that nobility and makes him feel important, makes him feel valued in the way she speaks to him, in the way she serves him. Vatemaher, and she hurries. Vatored kado al yodo vatashkei, and she takes it down in a hurry and she gives him to drink. Why in such a hurry? explains the Sipurnu. Ki hamehirus ba'avoidos hamesharis yoyre al heyos hanevad necheshav etzloi. That if an individual, if the person serving does so quickly with speed, that is indicative of the value he or she attaches to the person being served. Efficiency is an expression of value. That to serve somebody efficiently means I value you, I value your time, I value your custom, I value who you are, you're important to me. And so she does it, not only does she do it, but she does it efficiently and quickly. She finished giving him to drink. And then she says, Adin kilu lishtos, I will draw water for your camels until they're finished drinking. Now Eliezer had a whole lot of people with him. Eliezer brought a minion with him so that he could do the chasana and sheva brachas. And further on it says when they come to Besuel's house, that they make place for him and the Hanoshim Asherito, the people that were with him. So Eliezer wasn't alone. He brought other servants, he brought other people from the household of Avraham. So here's this young girl with 10 camels, and in South Africa we don't understand camels properly, but when a camel's thirsty and starts drinking, that's a lot of water. I think one year we actually calculated the weight of the water that she would need to draw in order to feed 10 camels. But the camels have drivers. There are young boys who came with Eliezer who are there to look after the camels. Why does she have to give the camels water? That's not what he asked for. She's already given him much more than he asked for. He asked for a taste of water and she's taking care of his needs fully. And then she offers to feed the camels. What message is that? What is she saying? And in our sense, what she would be saying is making a doormat of herself. She's a princess. What's she doing feeding camels when he has servants to do that? But in Rivka's language, what is she saying? It would be a privilege for me to carry on serving you. I don't want your people to serve the camels. I want to do it. I want that tzchus. I want to be able to serve you. I recognize something so great in you that this is a life experience for me to be able to serve you. What is she making Eliezer feel like? She's making Eliezer, who all she knows about him is that he's a slave. That's all she knows, but that there's something noble about him. And she's making him feel like a melech. She's making him feel like a king. That's all he has to know. That this is a girl that understands the importance of making somebody feel important. What greater test for a shidduch is there than that? Is there anything more that's needed? If a young man and a young woman get married, and each one knows only one thing, nothing else, they don't know any chumash, they don't know any gemara, they don't know any mishnayos, they've never read Shakespeare, nothing else. But there's one thing that they both know, and that is the ultimate importance of making the other feel important. That's the most important thing in life. My capacity to make other people feel like a king, other people feel like a queen, and that's my only and my most important obligation. And as we discussed in the Chovas Halvavos, that's our obligation with Hashem as well, that we have to do our avoda to Hashem. We have to recognize what Hashem has done to us and reciprocate in a way that, so to say, makes God feel good. Our ability to affect other people's feelings, that's the most important thing. We know very well about our own feelings. When we're feeling down, I'm feeling miserable, I don't feel well, I feel depressed, I feel angry, that we know about. But it's not that easy for us to change the way we feel. It's very easy for us to change the way other people feel. And if we would be as tuned into other people's feelings as we are to our own, nobody would feel miserable. Nobody would have depression. Nobody would be aggressive. And psychologists and psychiatrists would be totally unemployed. That would be the result of it. Because we think we can fix ourselves and we can't. Even Hashem, so to say, designs things in such a way that he can't fix himself. We have to fix Hashem. And in our interrelationships, we have to fix each other. Imagine a young boy and girl who haven't been to yeshiva, hasn't been to se- one thing they know for sure, that their ultimate responsibility is the feelings of the other. They have to take care of the feelings of the other. That's their ultimate responsibility. Is the shidduch going to work or isn't it? Of course it's going to work. And if everything else is there, he's been to Ponovich and she's been to Beis Yaakov, and he's got money and she's got money, and he comes from 10 generations of Rosh Yeshivas and she comes from 10 generations of Rosh Yeshivas, and everything's wonderful and he's as frum as can be and she's as frum as can be, but they don't know this one thing. That's the only part of the Torah they've never learned. Everything else they know, shuts from beginning to end. There's only one thing that they don't know, and that's tonight's Mitzvah Shabbos Shir. The only thing they never heard is the shidduch going to work or isn't it going to work. Can't work. They're going to be unhappy. says Eliezer, that's all I need to check. And I get the message from Avrom. And Avrom, after dealing with Ephraim, says, after that bit of business, I know one thing for sure. No daughter of Canaan for my son. I don't mind a family of idol worshippers, but not a family of Ayin Tzoro, not a family of narrow-minded people, of small-eyed people, not a family of mean people, not a family who think that they're going to build themselves up by knocking other people down. That's not for Yitzchak. There's only one requirement I have, implies Avrom to Eliezer, and that's the other way around. And look at the magnificence of Eliezer's test for Rivka. That's all he wants to know. Does she know how to make a person feel good? Does she know how to build a person up? Can she take an Eved, a strange Eved, and make him feel like a king? And Rivka passes with flying colors, not only thereby justifying for herself the position of the second of the Imohos, of the second of the mothers, but also laying down the foundations of the lessons that teach us the art of living.